Hello, I'm Adrian Finnegan, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, Europe has turned to Africa to replace Russian gas. It's now looking at the continent's green hydrogen potential to make the shift to renewables. But can African countries fill the energy gap? Also this week, the US, China and Russia are racing for political and economic influence on the continent, but at what cost? Plus, playing catch-up, Washington and Beijing are also competing for Africa's rare earth elements, which are critical to the production of renewable technologies. As Europe shuns Russian energy supplies, it's increasingly turning to Africa to find alternatives. The continent has vast natural gas reserves, but supplies only 6% of fossil fuel globally. African governments and businesses want to capitalize on the opportunity created by the war in Ukraine. But critics warn that millions of Africans lack electricity and supplies are much needed at home. Uma Kulsum Sharif reports.
Since Russia invaded Ukraine last year, several European leaders have visited African countries. They're looking for alternative energy suppliers. And the continent has some of the world's deepest natural gas reserves. Analysts say a lack of investment in energy infrastructure and security threats from armed groups have hampered development. But the war in Ukraine has presented an opportunity, one Algeria and Italy are already exploring.
The aim is to increase energy exports from Algeria to Italy and potentially on to Europe, including finding solutions to increase the volume of gas transported, a new pipeline that would also transport hydrogen, a new electrical undersea cable, and increased production of liquefied natural gas.
Senegal, too, is stepping up, increasing exports of LNG, liquefied natural gas, to Germany from 2.5 million tons this year to up to 10 million by 2030, which, it's hoped, will create much-needed employment.
We want to be able to have, whenever it comes to decision-making, this is a project for Senegal, for the development of the country, and it's important that we have our Senegalese national sitting at the table.
Some believe Europe's pivot towards Africa could solve the continent's own supply problems. The International Energy Agency estimates about 600 million Africans don't have power, while 900 million have no access to clean fuels for cooking.
We often have trouble getting electricity, but we think that with this plant, this will change little by little.
Currently, African countries provide around 20% of Europe's gas. And the energy crisis is fueling hope that the continent can increase its share. Uma Kulsum Sharif, Al Jazeera, for Counting the Cost.
Joining us now from Johannesburg is NJ Ayok. He's the executive chairman at the African Energy Chamber. Good to have you with us, NJ. How much of an opportunity for African countries has the war in Ukraine provided in terms of energy supplies?
The war in Ukraine has actually drained African energy supplies because there's been massive demand for a lot of natural gas going into Europe, in the sense that natural gas could have been used to either been exported or used with getting LNG across Africa to really power Africa. But Europe has been the biggest consumer of African natural gas. You've seen gas sales increase from Equatorial Guinea to Nigeria to Mozambique, actually shipping some of its first shipments from its floating LNGs into Europe and Algeria as well. So Europe has become Africa's biggest consumer of natural gas since the war in Ukraine started.
Africa has massive reserves, but does it have the capacity to ramp up supply?
It doesn't have the capacity to ramp up supply because there has been a massive underinvestment in African natural gas. For a long time, African natural gas has been put on a back foot because there have been issues around climate concerns, there have been lack of investment, underinvestment around exploration for natural gas, and even infrastructure development like the Nigeria pipeline going through Morocco and Algeria had not been developed, and new pipelines going in from Nigeria through West Africa and Senegal and Mauritania had not been developed. A lot of gas fields that are being stranded and have not seen that investment. That has been the problem for Africa right now. And I think right now we need to start thinking about having a game changer and really ramp up financing for infrastructure development and gas development. And floating LNGs are seen as a fast-track solution for right now for Africa.
Where's that investment going to come from? Given the massive potential for profit here, you'd think that people would be you know, knocking the door down to invest in Africa right now.
Well, I think the biggest issue around where people will be looking at investing in Africa around natural gas, you've seen massive gas reserves being found in Namibia, in Mozambique. Nigeria still has great potential with the Petroleum Industry Act that has been passed right now. They need to really see that financing, but we also have to take into consideration some of the strangleholds of financing. But Africans have to also do a part. They have to cut red tape, create an enabling environment, and really do deals faster. Sign new deals, but also in a sense where it shouldn't take too long to approve a project and the time it's needed to drive to build that project. And we need to look as Africans, we need to start thinking about how we address issues around resource nationalism. It doesn't work. And when we do those things, investment will flow in even during these difficult moments.
Critics, though, NJ, say that Africa needs to fix its internal supply problems first before it exports its resources to other countries. I mean, how do African governments strike a balance?
There is a healthy balance that can be done here. 600 million Africans don't have access to electricity. 900 million have no access to clean cooking technologies, most of them women. The continent is still seeing massive underdevelopment and industrialization. So that natural gas, it's needed. We can strike that healthy balance to really deliver gas to our European partners and also at the same time be able to drive not just gas to power projects, but also petrochemicals and all of that. But it all gets linked up towards investment, but also the climate, the polarization that we've seen around the world when it comes to gas, it's really hurting Africa the most because gas is being polarized. At the same time, the same European countries have declared gas green, and gas is green for Europe, but not green for Africa. And we need to be very careful about it. Even coal, that they're telling us to abandon coal, they are using coal to power Europe right now, while in South Africa today, they're going 8 to 10 hours with no electricity and blackouts per day. So we need to find that balance, and we need to curb down on the polarization that we see. And some of the politicians need to watch their language.
In the scramble for natural gas, is Europe ignoring Africa's potential for renewable energy sources?
Absolutely. Africa has vast potential for renewable sources. We just started this conversation talking about green hydrogen. There's amazing amounts of potential to really deliver green hydrogen and maybe green ammonia into Europe and within Africa and really drive that low carbon economy that can really deal with heavy industries. Look at Morocco, some of the projects happening there, Egypt, Algeria, but come right down to Southern Africa, South Africa, Namibia. They've seen amazing amounts. Some of the biggest green hydrogen deals have been signed in Mauritania and Senegal, and that great potential that has to come. But we also have to pay attention to the fact that even if we're going to move in this green economy and low carbon economy, Africa has seen less than 2% of global investment in renewables. That is not right. That needs to be increased and that needs to be ramped up if you're going to really achieve a just energy transition. You can't tell Africans to decarbonize, which there's nothing to decarbonize, but at the same time, you're not matching those words with financing, with funding. And we're not talking aid. We're talking real credit lines. We're talking financing and investments that will really go on and give Africa a fighting chance to really industrialize while some of the wealthy nations can decarbonize at this time.
NJ, it's been great to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you.
China has spent two decades expanding its political and economic relations with Africa. Today, one in three major infrastructure projects on the continent is built by Chinese state-owned enterprises. That's according to the US. But Beijing isn't alone. Russia is widening its involvement there too, mainly through arms sales and mining projects. Now, after 4 years of neglect under the Trump administration, President Joe Biden wants to win Africa back. His administration's officials have toured the continent over the past few months in a bid to unlock American investments there. Among them is Vice President Kamala Harris, who's announced billions of dollars in investments to Ghana, Tanzania and Zambia. Biden has committed $55 billion in financial assistance to Africa over the next 3 years. He's also increased humanitarian aid to African countries, mainly those battling food insecurity. Well, here's a look at how American investments in Africa compare to Chinese ones. China was the continent's largest two-way trading partner in 2021, with more than $254 billion worth of business. The United States Institute of Peace says that's four times the amount of trade between the US and Africa. A new study by the Center for Global Development says that Chinese banks provided $23 billion to infrastructure projects in sub-Saharan Africa between 2007 and 2020. That's more than double the amount lent by such banks in the US, Germany, Japan and France combined. Beijing is the largest provider of foreign direct investment, supporting hundreds of thousands of African jobs. That's nearly double the level of US foreign direct investment. Chinese lending to African countries has dropped lately, but the nation remains by far the largest lender to African countries. China's critics accuse it of deliberately lending to African countries that it knows can't repay the money to increase its political influence. Beijing denies practicing so-called debt trap diplomacy and says partnerships are built in good faith. The US also accuses Russia's Wagner Group, which has secured many mining projects in Africa, of committing human rights abuses and of extorting natural resources in African countries. Joining us now from London is Alex Vines. He's the director of the Africa Programme, the managing director of Ethics, Risk and Resilience at Chatham House. Alex, good to have you with us. Why are Russia, China and the US racing to build economic ties with Africa right now?
We're in an era of multipolarity, and Africa has plenty of natural resources. It has strategic and critical minerals. It has a very large agricultural base, and so it's a market that many countries want to be engaged in, although the reality is that we are in a bit of a retreat just at the moment because of the state of the global economy and high lending rates. So the kind of cost of providing funding has gone significantly up. And so there's still plenty of activity on the African continent, but it is much dampened compared with what it was, say, in 2019, 2020.
So putting aside the downturn for the moment, how does Africa approach this, doing business with three competing powers?
Yeah, I mean, not just three competing powers. I mean, add in the Gulf states, Turkey, the members of the European Union. So it is a really crowded, frenetic marketplace. And I think the word non-alignment, I think, is the most apparent that comes to mind. Many African countries, not all of them, many of them want to be non-aligned. They do not want to be pigeonholed. And so they prefer choosing an a la carte approach. They want to kind of pick and choose what's good for them. And I think that's the new reality that we're dealing with. So that's not bad if you've got lots of suitors, as long as you negotiate a good deal. In fact, playing off Russia and China and some Gulf states and maybe some Europeans, you might get a better deal if you're able to manage and negotiate that well.
The Biden administration is stepping up its campaign to win Africa back. What areas is it looking to invest in, and how does that differ from the areas that China and Russia are investing in?
The Americans are definitely very concerned about access of strategic and critical minerals for their industrial complex back in the United States. They've had a number of high-level meetings about this, including on the fringes of the UN. So countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo come to mind. The US has looked at how to support infrastructure, but their infrastructure companies are not doing too well, and some are actually retreating at the moment. So the headline from the Biden administration are very positive. You've just mentioned the figures. The reality of corporate America following behind at the moment is very sluggish. If you look at the Kamala Harris trip that you mentioned, the vice president of the United States to Ghana, Zambia, I forget the one other country, Tanzania, I think it might have been. There wasn't so much corporate America tied to that trip, despite what she was saying. And there, I think there is a problem for the United States. They really do need to get a lot more corporate American companies focused on the African market than they have at the moment.
China is accused once again of setting debt traps across the continent. Is it?
Good question. This is a piece of work that we ourselves did at Chatham House, published in the last December. And we looked at where China was really investing. So the reality is that China's FDI and investments are deep, but in a smaller number of countries, particularly seven or eight countries, which we focused on. When we looked at those in depth, we didn't find evidence of debt trap, except potentially in one, and that's Djibouti. And that's because of its geostrategic position on the Gulf of Aden. Many countries have strategic interests there because of its location, both in terms of the Gulf of Aden itself, but also because of access to the hinterland, Ethiopia. So I don't think that the evidence stacks up on rhetoric on debt trap, which tends to be not only out of Washington, although less so just recently, but Japan and India tend to kind of use that rhetoric. But there's the research that we've done doesn't support that.
And what about what Russia is doing in Africa? In 2019, President Putin said that he was going to double investment on the continent. Has that materialized, given the sanctions that are in place against Russia, given the war in Ukraine?
So the Russians have their second Russia-Africa summit planned for July this year in St. Petersburg. So it'll be interesting to see who shows up and what the headlines are there, particularly from the commercial side. The reality when I talk to Russians is it's been very difficult for them in terms of investment. There are some niche areas still where Russia is investing, has long-standing investments in the Republic of Guinea on bauxite. And I've just seen figures through in terms of exports of fuel products, kerosene and other things have significantly increased in a couple of African countries, particularly North African ones, but also Nigeria, which I think is a reconfiguration of trade with the African continent, given EU and Western sanctions. And so those exports are going elsewhere. But Russia is struggling, except in a few countries where, as you've mentioned, their private military company, Wagner, has been active and has struck deals to extract minerals in exchange for security services.
Good to talk to you, Alex. Many thanks indeed for being with us on Counting the Cost.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Africa is also at the heart of a geopolitical scramble for rare earth minerals. Demand for those elements is increasing globally as governments around the world pledge to reduce their emissions and make the transition to green energy. The metals are used in the production of electric vehicles and wind turbines and other renewable technologies, and many African nations have large deposits of them. But Chinese miners control most commercial exports of minerals in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zambia and Tanzania, for example. And Beijing refines as much as 60% of the world's lithium and more than 60% of its cobalt, according to a report by the Brookings Institution and Results for Development. The US wants to decrease its reliance on China and is turning to Africa for the minerals. Joining us now from Idaho in the United States, Peter Major, the Director of Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions. Good to have you with us, Peter. How significant are Africa's deposits of rare earth minerals?
Well, Adrian, like a lot of things, we don't really know how significant they are. We just know Africa is the largest continent in the world, other than Asia, and it's probably the least explored. Even though man has been here for a few hundred years, Western man, it's huge and it's rich. And just the Congo alone is bigger than Europe. And Congo has gone from almost virtually 50,000 tons of copper production a year to almost 2 million tons just in the last 20 years. And that's just one country out of a huge continent. And it's because there hasn't been a demand large enough that couldn't be met with the rest of the world. If we see Chile in South America produces almost a third of the world's copper, but it's now peaked for the last 10 years. It can't produce much more copper. It's slowly going down, but the world population keeps growing and the demand for copper keeps going. And so now more and more countries are turning to Africa, even though it's still quite disorganized, even though it's quite still third world. It is hugely, hugely rich and still relatively unexplored. And that includes all minerals, not just copper, and rare earths, without a doubt, are going to be probably more abundant in China, in Africa, than they even are in China, with more money put into exploration.
So, Peter, what are the challenges for Africa then in realizing its full potential?
We hear a word in South Africa used quite frequently by the West, and now it's used by South Africans themselves, although they don't like the word, and it's called policy. And even if you were very disorganized, even if you were very poor, even if you are very corrupt or crime-ridden, if you have the correct policies on board, you will attract money, real money. And we don't mean hot money that comes in today and leaves tomorrow. We mean bricks and mortar money. And that's unfortunately been a lot of Africa's problem, is their policies change too often. Probably their second problem in Africa is they can't enforce the policy when they get a good one. And so if you have a bad policy, you attract the wrong money. Africa needs money invested there. Okay. But you want the right money and you need the right policy to get the right money.
And also, I mean, I suppose under policy comes security. There's a lot of unrest in many countries in Africa. And people who invest want to know that their assets, what they're investing into, is secure.
They certainly do, Adrian. And amazingly enough, even though governments can't always provide that security, if they have the correct policy, the Western countries, the Western investors, and let me not prejudice anyone, you know, China, Asia, even Russia. If there's a correct policy, they will bring the money and they will bring in security, because the metal prices are so high now that the margin that they can make is large enough to allow for the security.
Peter, how much control does China have over Africa's rare earth market and pricing? To what extent has China stolen a march on the US? Is it trying to get a look in now at increasing its investment?
It is. And right now, I don't think China has very much control over Africa's rare earths, because oddly enough, and let's get specific here. The rare earth elements, they're not copper, lithium, zinc, cobalt. Rare earth elements, there's 17 funny sounding names. And the reason China got such great control over them is through most of humanity, there were more rare earths than man knew what to do with. The US was a much larger producer up until the 1990s, the late 90s, than was China. But China needed rare earths. And boy, it put focus and money into it. And it was producing rare earths much cheaper than anybody else in the world could. So all the other production closed down and only China was producing. Then by the end of the 90s, the early millennium, now there's all of a sudden, with technology advancing like it is, now the use for rare earth elements, all 17 of them, and there's only a few thousand tons a year that get produced. Now the demand is large enough that China can start raising prices, and they keep raising prices, and the world's happy to buy from China. China doesn't control Africa's rare earths. We've hardly found rare earths in Africa, and yet it's got some good deposits, especially South Africa and especially Rwanda. And they're not Chinese controlled yet, but as we saw in Zimbabwe is a rising star in lithium, And it wasn't the Chinese that found the lithium in Zimbabwe. It was the Australians. And the Chinese have now bought the two largest lithium deposits in Zimbabwe.
Peter, it's been great to talk to you on Cutting the Cost. Many thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Adrian. I really appreciate your time.
And that's our show for this week. Get in touch with us if you want to comment on anything that you've seen. You can tweet me. I'm at A. Finnegan on Twitter. Try to remember to use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or you can drop us a line. CountingTheCost@AlJazeera.net is our email address. There's plenty more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page. There you'll find individual reports, links, and entire episodes to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the team here in Doha. Thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.